truth or any kind of frank talk about, and telling you the truth as I see it right here on Revolution Radio, the premier listener-supported network. Please go to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com and make a donation to keep this kind of talk going. Well, all right, let's see what we can do here as far as bringing up my second hour guest. That's Vinny Eastwood. Vinny Eastwood. Oh, there he is. He's already up. Vinny, how did you get up so early?
Well, let's just say I'm broadcasting live from the future.
You are, and I can see you, but unfortunately, your good looks are completely wasted on all of our radio audience, given that we're an audio-only show. So,
well, that's
so
all right. I'm recording it, and I will put it up on YouTube afterwards.
Okay, okay.
So you can turn your webcam on, too, if you want me to make a video out of this one with you.
I didn't put on my mascara today, so no, I can't do that.
I thought that was forbidden in Islam, bro.
No, that's lipstick.
All right.
No, especially on a pig. A pig is already haram, and you put lipstick on the pig, then it's doubly haram.
All right.
So, Vinny, I see that you have two different Skype accounts. One is Vincent Eastwood and one is Vinny Eastwood. Is Vincent for when you're applying for jobs at high-powered investment houses, and Vinny when you're going to just work at the local spaghetti house? Or how does this work? No,
it's because I've got two iMacs right next to each other. And when I want to do a show where I'm sharing the screen and I'm showing people stuff and what have you, I need a second computer to be able to do that simultaneously while both accounts are connected. And the other element is when I need to do videos on shows, in which case the one that I'm on now has the better webcam and better with the lighting that I've got here.
Well, you're so lucky that you have two really cool names. They both work. Vinny works. Vinny's a great name. And Vincent is a great name, too, like Van Gogh and everything. You know, I only have one name, Kevin. And, like, my grandma used to call me Kevy. But I don't like it when other people do that. Some of them do anyway, but it's just I couldn't have a Kevy Barrett Skype account because like I would fall on the floor laughing at myself if I even tried that.
Yeah, you could be in a movie, you know, you could change your last name to Chase.
There you go. Or I could adopt an Islamic name. You know, I've considered a couple of them. They used to call me Si Lakhdar when I was in Morocco, which means the green guy. I guess my complexion was a little off in those days. I don't know why.
And it had nothing to do with your marijuana consumption, but
no, Vinny. I'm the only American in all of history who spent a year in Morocco and never so much as took a single toke.
Well,
seriously,
shisha. I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. I even went to Chef Shaouen, which is apparently one of the marijuana capitals, but I see it as one of the spiritual capitals. It used to be so spiritual that they didn't even allow non-Muslims to go there. It was that spiritual. But now everybody goes there, and it's gorgeous. And there's this cafe on a bridge over this beautiful mountain stream rushing down from a huge mountain looming right above the town. And I sat there at that cafe, and the closest I ever got to getting high during the entire year I was in Morocco was sitting at that cafe and just breathing the secondhand smoke. But that was still a lot of fun just hanging out at that place. So if you're ever in Morocco, go to Chef Shaouen. Beautiful, beautiful town. And Shadili, the great Sufi saint, it has a tomb off in the mountains there. Man, I kind of miss Morocco. What am I doing being a professional conspiracy theorist stuck in Midwestern USA when I could be off doing Sufism in Morocco?
Yeah, we've all been there, bro.
Well, you could be off in South Island somewhere doing a roundabout or a layabout or whatever kind of spiritual practice the people of New Zealand have.
The people of New Zealand, for their spiritual well-being, smoke weed, and that's it. Like basically, we and or drink to excess while watching rugby. Right, those are our two spiritual avenues in this country, and naturally, the alcoholics and the stoner religion both kind of hate each other and misunderstand each other.
You know, I thought materialism and consumerism and decadence had gone about as far as it could go right here in the USA, but I guess I'm wrong. I guess it's gone even further in New Zealand.
Well, you know, we favor our sacraments.
Okay, well, Vinny, you know New Zealand pretty well. I mean, you're the voice of New Zealand as far as I'm concerned. You know, I've heard more Vinny than any other New Zealander, and I'm sure a lot of my listeners probably could say the same over the past, you know, decade or however long it's been since you've been yapping over the internet airwaves. So you're like the voice of your nation. That's a heavy responsibility, dude.
Well, you know, and at this point, I'm still the only one, you know, and that kind of makes me really ashamed.
You know, New Zealand's only professional conspiracy and comedy guy?
Well, pretty much. I mean, it's sort of like I found a niche.
You pretty much are the niche. I mean, pretty much worldwide even. I mean, I try to do a little bit of comedy, but I still can't quite make it a professional thing the way you can. So I don't know how you do it. And plus, you're leading the global crusade against scumbaggery.
Mm. Well, you know, if you suffer throughout the vast extent of your life in one way or another, don't get loved enough and so on and so forth, all that good stuff, then you develop a really cutting sense of humor in order to help you survive with it. It's known as gallows humor. And frankly, there's no better time than dark times for dark comedy.
And, you know, I've been saying this, you know, since I figured out 9/11, that there's just so much material for theater of the absurd and humour noir. I used to study that stuff back in the day. Before I came to Islam, Vinny, few people know this, I was actually a sort of an existentialist and absurdist. I fell in love with a lot of French, wild and crazy French literature, starting with the poetry of Arthur Rimbaud, moving on to these existentialists and absurdists, Ionesco and Beckett and those kind of people had this very dark vision, and Sartre, Camus to a certain extent, they had this dark vision of a meaningless universe that was really, in many cases, only redeemed by this very, very dark humor. So I went, you know, been there, done that. That was when I was young and stupid and naive. And now I'm a grown, mature Muslim, and I take life very spiritually. But, you know, post 9/11, the world has gotten so weird. And this hoax, this monstrous hoax of 9/11, which opened the door for many of us to look at all these other monstrous hoaxes, you know, the difference between the way things really are and what they tell us is so vast that it's almost beyond funny. I mean, it only hurts when I laugh. It's just, you know, how can you be serious about it and not go crazy?
Well, I don't know about you, but I get comments all the time telling me that I should take things more seriously and stop making jokes and so on and so forth. And I don't understand their reasoning, right? It's like, dude, if you want somebody who's taking it really seriously and making you feel afraid and talking about incredibly serious stuff all the time with no reprieve, you have infinite choices in the both alternative and mainstream media spectrum, okay? But if you want to have fun while you're talking about your enslavements and subsequent extermination, there's only one. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, where the only thing worse than the truth is Vinnie's jokes.
Well, in a way, you're kind of the anti-Alex Jones, because you and Alex talk about precisely the same stuff, the scumbaggery conspiracy to take over the world for the New World Order, followed by the extermination of most of the population, and Alex, though, he kind of puts out this vibe of you know, fear and anger and he's very serious most of the time. It's very everyone's, you know, sometimes he's unintentionally funny, but not that often. Whereas you are putting out the same information, the same incredibly grim stuff, but with a totally different vibe.
Well, it has to be fun to listen to, right? Look, just because we're being enslaved and exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of getting enslaved and exterminated? You know, it wouldn't make sense to me otherwise.
Well, there you go. Of course, you know, some people find that offensive. Like just in the last hour, I had Ian Greenhall on here, and I'll be darned if we didn't start cracking Holocaust jokes. Seriously, there are people who would be very, very offended if they go back. Like if you're listening to this recording, folks, and you missed the end of the hour with Ian Greenhall, that was like even more twisted humor than you're usually going to get from Vinnie Eastwood. And so people get very offended sometimes by this stuff. How do you deal with that when they like call you up and say they're coming to kill you because they're so offended by your jokes?
Well, they don't threaten to come and kill me. In fact, I haven't had a death threat in like 6 years. I mean,
you need to work harder.
I don't know. Maybe it's because intelligence agencies and trolls and psychopathic narcissists have a sense of humor and they're like, you know what? There's nobody else doing this. I actually enjoy this guy laughing at everybody's demise that I'm helping to cause. So, you know, let's just leave him be and just flood his inbox with abusive trolls who don't threaten to kill him, but are just kind of there to buzz around his head like bees in a nest, driving him mad, right? That's the kind of thing that I have to deal with on a daily basis. You know, people on Facebook and YouTube who don't have any followers, don't have any subscribers, have never made a video in their life, telling me that I'm doing it wrong and that I should do something the exact same way that everybody else is doing it and have no unique expression. You know, and I'm just like, bro, I could explain to you why you're wrong, but blocking the scum is gone. See, there you go, right there. I don't like sitting around allowing people who basically have no validation for their opinions trying to give me theirs, right? It doesn't make any progress, shall we say. Now, I did a Facebook status on this today because this Islamophobia thing, I did an interview with Adam Kokesh, and he actually did I think it was back in 2007, I think. He started putting up posters around a university in the States mocking the threat of Islam, saying that why are you afraid of Islam when your own government is the real threat? And, well, your chance of being killed by a terrorist is 1 in 20 million. So, yes, it is Islamophobic to think Muslims are anything close to a threat. Were Islamic extremists the biggest cause of unnatural death in the 20th century? No. Democratically elected governments were. And they are still the number one cause of death. So why trust them when they say that Islam is a threat?
But wait a minute, Vinny, out of the, what is it, nearly 300,000 people who are run over by cars every year, like a couple of them just happened to get run over. Actually, it's more, it's millions run over. Maybe I forget how many 100,000 killed by automobiles on pedestrians. We had a couple of them over on Westminster Bridge in front of the British Parliament the other day. And that is supposed to convince us that Muslims are really bad drivers. No, they're out to get us. If there's a Muslim on the road somewhere, he's probably going to ram his car into you, right? I mean, what do you think about this kind of thing where the media takes, like, you know, these, like, what, three people killed by vehicles out of the, I forget how many hundreds or thousands are killed every day by vehicles all over the planet, and turns it into a publicity stunt about radical Islam?
Well, it turns out that a lot of the things were fake. Like, I saw this great video of this guy, and all the imagery of all of these people, there's no blood. Like, they've been carried, they've got their pants cut completely up, right?
Really? I should have kept Ian, because Ian tells us the opposite. Ian wrote a piece about this saying that it was real, that there really were people run over.
Yeah, sure. But the video I watched with this dude analyzing the Masonic imagery and all of that kind of stuff, all of these, you know, victims and everything like that, no blood. No blood whatsoever, no injuries, their clothes were cut up and no blood. Like, for some reason, an explosion or a car or whatever can do this. And I'm just like, oh my God, it's just ridiculous. So I started making jokes about it, of course. That's what you do. And Lewis Black, the American comedian, he said that his job is to be crazier than what people are seeing on TV. And he said he doesn't know what his job is anymore. Because the stuff that you see on TV is just so stupid. Here's one status that I put up. If Britain and the US kill a million Iraqis, nobody panics because it's all part of the plan. But if one Muslim kills five Brits, well, then everyone loses their mind. You know? There's no kind of concept of what terrorism actually is in terms of a threat response. Nobody knows how to respond to the threat accurately, so they are in a fear paradigm. Now, when you're afraid, it means that your brain activity is in your lower cortex and your reptilian brain, which governs your fight or flight responses. Do I have to kill this thing or do I have to run away from it? Those are about the two most sophisticated thoughts that you can come up with when you've got the hell scared out of you. Now, terrorism, by definition, look it up in the dictionary, ladies and gentlemen, a system of government by which the state terrorizes its own citizens into compliance with its policies.
Now, that's pretty much what's happening today. But which dictionary is that, Vinny? That's too truthful to be in a real dictionary, isn't it?
Oh, no. I think it might have been the Oxford. Could have been the Collins as well. Who knows? But still, look it up in the dictionary and you'll find that terrorism, just like fascism and capitalism and communism, are isms that are formations of government. All right? Now, I did want to say, what do you call a movie about false flag terror attacks in England?
I don't know. Westminster Bridge, or V for Vendetta, the sequel. No, tell me.
London Has Fallen for It.
There you go. London Falling for It. That sounds like The Clash.
Well,
yeah.
One can only hope. Now, on top of this, we get this massive hysteria and the huge amount of articles coming out of it in the mainstream media. And I think it was day before yesterday I did my show live and my guest didn't turn up, so I had to kind of wing it. And so I opened up the New Zealand Herald website, and what's there? A shockingly large amount of articles about this London terror attack. Okay? And it's up here in the top corner, it says, what are our most popular articles? Number one, number two, and number five. Out of the five top
carnage
articles.
In London.
Were terror in London. Oh, yeah. The terror. You know,
Big Ben looms above scene of carnage. Oh, man,
now,
that's sexy.
Thing is, about being offended, okay, Steve Hughes thought this a very interesting bit of comedy. And, well, I went to a comedy show and he said something and I was offended. And then tomorrow, and then yesterday, I woke up with cancer. You see, like, what does offending actually do to you? Well, you get offended. Now, a lot of people go through this thing called puberty, where they grow up, allegedly, where they're capable of handling things like, what's the word? Adults! And apparently, that's just not allowed to happen anymore. If you get offended, suddenly everybody has to be, a guidance counsellor for you. Everybody has to watch what they say and walk on eggshells and not say what they really think, which is the whole idea.
You have to create safe spaces, Vinny. Safe spaces, don't you realize?
Yeah, yeah. Kind of like
it's all about being safe.
Yeah, right. Just sort of like how all the mass shootings in the United States happen in gun ban zones. You know, that's what happens when you create a safe space. You breed in weakness.
Well, it's kind of asking for it. Like if you say, oh, my classroom is a safe space where we don't want any off-color remarks about any minorities or genders, you're almost just begging somebody to come up with some off-color remark. It's just like when you're going through the TSA checkpoint at the airport and there's a big sign. I remember it used to be like this way before 9/11. They had signs that said, do not joke about guns, bombs, and hijacking. Seriously, there were signs that said that. And so every time I walked through those checkpoints, I just couldn't resist saying something like, hey, you heard the one about guns, bombs, and hijacking? And, you know, it's asking for it. They're asking for it.
Yeah. A gun runner, a bomber, and a hijacker walk into a bar.
There you go. and you're under arrest.
No, seriously, Leo, somebody try that. You go up to a TSA agent, a gun runner, a bomber, and a hijacker walk into a bar.
but isn't it interesting, though? They took down the signs after 9/11. They had those signs up because people apparently were, at that point, still, they would go through the checkpoint and they would joke about guns, bombs, and hijacking. So they had to put up signs saying, don't joke about guns, bombs, and hijacking. But after 9/11, everybody was so terrorized that they just took down the signs because everybody knew that you would never joke about anything like that. In fact, you'll just let them grope you and not even protest. I mean, it's, you know, there's no more joking at TSA.
Mm. Mate, that's it. It's a terrible world you live in when humor is actually treated more seriously than murder. All right, think about it. Government murders people all day, every day, pretty much. I can guarantee you, like, right now, at this very minute, somebody's being executed by a cop or tortured by the CIA or some kind of horrific violation of somebody's rights and their life. Now, do people get up in arms and offended about that? Or do they get really upset when Vinny Eastwood from New Zealand makes a little joke about Islam? You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, what kind of jokes are you telling about Islam, Vinny? Well, let me make sure that they're kosher. Islamically kosher.
That would be halal.
Halal. You got halal jokes? You should start a halal joke stand.
Halalious.
There you go.
Yeah, his jokes are hilarious.
Hey, that might be a good website, hilarious.com.
I just came up with a Muslim joke. Boom, right there.
Not bad, Vinny. Not bad. You should give Azhar Usman a run for his money. He's my favorite Muslim comedian.
Mm. I mean, well, the thing is, if you're a Muslim and you're telling jokes, you might scare the hell out of people.
Yeah. Yeah. You probably wouldn't want to say, yeah. You heard the one about guns, bombs, and hijacking, or, you know. I can make you explode with laughter. Yeah.
I can just imagine that the Muslim terrorist comedian. I'm going to make you laugh until you die from it. I think I wrote a Chuck Norris movie, man.
I wrote a satirical piece about something like that a while back, but that's another problem I have, Vinny, is these days I write these totally satirical pieces. They're way over the top. Nobody could possibly take them seriously, right? Well, reality is so crazy that people do take them seriously. They don't get the joke. Sometimes they'll just scan my headline and they'll think it's a real story. And so I get these comments on my satirical stories that are so ludicrous. I mean, how could anybody think this was real? Well, you know, reality is now a plastic thing. It's not, you know, there's no way to know it's real anymore. And I guess that's good. You know, I think that you and me and the rest of the conspiracy theorists, we basically destroyed people's sense of reality. They know now that all this crazy stuff that we talk about actually could be true. And so, you know, this is partly why Trump got elected, because it used to be only the African Americans that didn't believe the official reality here in the U.S. And now the white working class people don't believe it either. So Trump could get elected by just beating the heck out of the media, being beat up by the media and everybody.
And telling everybody to
believe the media.
And let's not forget telling everybody to be afraid of a particular racial group and a particular economic class. All right.
Well, and that's part of the problem is if people don't know what to believe, then a demagogue like Trump can come along and tell a little bit of truth about this and that. But then he can also mainly get elected by scapegoating, by whipping up these crazed fears of powerless groups, diverting people's attention away from the real powerful people who are picking their pockets towards these scapegoated groups. And because people's sense of reality has been wiped out, they don't know, you know, they don't have enough knowledge to realize that he's lying to them.
Well, they don't have enough background knowledge that every single dictator who's been elected throughout history said more or less the exact same things in order to instill fear in the public and get elected, and then wound up abusing their power and so on and so forth. So that's where everybody comes up with these Hitler comparisons. It's like, you don't just need to compare him to Hitler. Compare him to Pol Pot. Compare him to Chairman Mao. Compare him to Mussolini. You know,
or Franco or Pinochet.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's cast the net a little bit wider. You know, why do the Nazis get all the credit?
Well, the Nazis seem to really have, you know, taken over that number one villain role in our culture. They're basically the new devil. And Hitler is the new devil. And the Hitler mustache is now the iconography of evil, the way that the horns and the pitchfork used to be. And it's just, I guess that's maybe a reflection of the way World War II was written up and mythologized afterwards by the victors, who had been so evil in the way they waged that war. You know, just if you read books like The Good War, and was it Mike King wrote that, The Good War, and what else? There are a number of these kind of revisionist World War II, not so much Holocaust revisionists necessarily, but just World War II revisionist books that focus on the crimes of the Allies. Hellstorm is another one. You realize, man, that no wonder we had to make Hitler into the devil, because we were the devils, and, you know, we had to make somebody else look even worse than us.
As Major General Smedley Butler once said, war is a racket. And the thing about World War II that a lot of people don't realize, I just watched a John Pilger documentary, his latest 2016 documentary called The War on China. And it actually goes through what happened to the people in the Bikini and Marshall Islands. And they came in there and they said to everybody in the islands who were very, very healthy, very, very happy, lived in frickin' paradise, had all the fish and shellfish and coconuts and breadfruit that they could eat when at any day. And all of a sudden, a massive nuke at 6:30 in the morning goes off. And the children were out playing, and all of a sudden this dust started falling from the sky. Children held out their hands and started rubbing it into their hair while they were in the well, trying to wash their hair with it like it was soap. And then their hair started falling out. And now there's these massive nuclear missile testing facilities there, where they'll shoot intercontinental ballistic missiles from the other side of the Pacific at the Marshall Islands just to test them, right? And they have the highest rate of diabetes in the world now because all of their islands are now contaminated and they can't actually eat any of their own food. They can't eat any of their own fish. They have to survive 100% on processed imports with no nutritional value. And when they were told that their islands were safe and that they should now go back to them, the US was testing them all the time, taking their blood and so on and so forth, noticing all their cancers. And they just used an entire generation of people as guinea pigs without their knowledge, just to see what radiation would do to the people who were in the testing grounds, you know?
And there was another segment of that same set of experiments that the U.S. did through the Israelis on these Eastern Jewish kids, these Arab Jews. Sephardic Jews, but you can just call them Jewish Arabs because that's what they are. I mean, Arabs are just people whose first language is Arabic, and some of those people had Judaism as their religion. And when Israel was created, the Zionists tried to get all those people chased out of wherever they were so they could go to Israel. And as they brought them to Israel, they tested them. Well, they brought them in and put the kids through this horrific radiation, this series of you know, irradiations that killed a huge number of them and left, you know, horrible scars on the rest. This was done by Israeli Zionist Jews on other Jewish people, and it was done for the Americans. The Americans actually paid the Israelis to do this. And there are a number of other examples as well of these kinds of radiation experiments. And Vinny, I don't know, have you looked into this claim that the nuclear weapons complex is somehow tied into sort of satanic Freemasonry? David Dionysi has written, for example, about how Hiroshima and Nagasaki are, the story is different from what we were told, that actually the real target was always Nagasaki, and that it was targeted to get rid of its cathedral and its Christian population, because these people are basically Freemasonic Satanists who hate Christianity. So they targeted the cathedral in Nagasaki. That was the number one target. And the Hiroshima run was just a dry run for that. It's a really interesting revisionist look at this. And that's just one data point of a number of them that are all pointing at the nuclear weapons world as being sort of intersecting with a kind of satanic Freemasonic cult. Have you read any of that stuff?
Not specifically. However, I have interviewed James Robert Wright and Freighter X, and these are two of the highest ranking Freemason whistleblowers for 100 years. The last two people who blew the whistle in the early 1900s, one was executed in the police cells, and another was taken in broad daylight by a black Masonic coach and never seen again. And these guys are still alive, thank God, but they're having real hard times, man, like real hard times, stalked and having job prospects dried up or anything like that. The Masons have such a broad spectrum of control of and influence in so many sectors that to really speak out against them and to speak out with authority, as these men have, is a dangerous business. Now,
well, what kind of information have these guys revealed?
what every single one of their rituals actually is and what it actually means, what all their symbolism and numerology comes from, the origins of Freemasonry, the overall plan of Freemasonry, how there is in fact a secret war going on inside Freemasonry for the Blue Lodge and all others versus the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, which is the 33rd degree, and that's controlled by the Scottish Rite headquarters in Dallas. Now, when Trump got elected and picked his cabinet, I just Googled all the names of the cabinet members plus the word Freemason plus the word Trilateral Commission plus the word Council on Foreign Relations and plus the word Council on National Policy, and I got a hit on every single one of them pretty much.
Oh, come on, Vinny. I thought Trump was going to clean out the stables, you know, he was going to drain the swamp. You can't tell me that Trump would be appointing insiders like that.
Yeah, well, apparently the only people he appointed as insiders, like pretty much. So if people want to continue to believe and go and take the wait and see approach, you know, I can see, you know, a credit for that. Who knows? Because of the fact that there is so much confusion being sowed. And this is the real interesting thing here, and this is where it ties into the military-industrial complex, particularly military intelligence, is that state intelligence agencies like the CIA or back in World War II, the OSS, are often family affairs. And just like Freemasonry, where you can only really be allowed in the club unless if your father is one or if you are invited by one, all right? And they have a secret oath to the Brotherhood, and they have a threat of being buried up to their neck at the low tide mark in sand or having their throat cut from ear to ear if they ever reveal the secrets, right? This is the kind of cult that people get themselves into. Now, if you've got that, you've got a secret society with a million membership that's in nearly every continent. If you've got intelligence agencies that are connected by blood, right, then you have a even larger, more powerful, secure apparatus for global manipulation and control. Because it's all in the family, you can never get out of the agency, and you have an oath to keep that you will die if you don't. Can you think of a more perfect system to steer global events from behind the scenes than that? I can't.
Well, they use various kinds of symbolism. Freemasonry is obsessed with symbolism, and numerology is one kind of symbolism. And some of us wondered about the second year in a row where we had a big, spectacular, global headlines-making terror event on March 22nd. It's not just that 22 is a multiple of 11, and it seems like the majority of these things have some 11 in there somewhere, but it's also that March 22nd is the third and culminating day of the three-day satanic feast of Pelusia, which is supposedly the satanic Freemasons make something of this. I don't know. But
well, the secret number of Skull and Bones, which John Kerry, George W. Bush,
right,
and even the new Goldman Sachs representative in Trump's cabinet, Steven Mnuchin, all went to. And their secret number is 322. Now, it's a strange thing, and you have to really look into it quite a bit because it's all confusing, okay? If I'm trying to teach you Japanese, you're not going to understand what I'm teaching you until you've been learning it for a couple of years, and then you'll actually be able to speak the language a little bit yourself or pick up phrases here or there. And the same is true with teaching people about numerology, Freemasonry, secret societies in general, because you have to have a vocabulary for it. You have to have an awareness of it before you can even begin to understand it. And that's what I try to do. I just try to give people a little bit of awareness of it. And I know that they're going to call me a conspiracy theorist. I know they're not going to believe it. And I know that they're not going to research into it. But I know that they also can't unhear it.
And didn't we just have, was it the 300th anniversary of the first Scottish Rite Lodge? Was the 400th? Remind me that we just had that this year, didn't we?
I don't know.
You didn't hear that. Yeah, maybe people can pull that up. But then the question is, what is it really all about? Is it just about global control, as you suggested. Obviously, many people who join it use it primarily as a way to get ahead in the world.
There's a secret war going on inside this organization. So there's good people and bad people in there. I mean, I've got at least four Masons that I know of that are good personal friends who I trust, who I know aren't bad people, who I know don't go to the lodge and talk politics afterwards. And Fredericks did this interesting video series. He talks about these different types of Masons. He talked about political Masons, numerological Masons, and there's also porch Masons and so on and so forth. There's five types or whatever. But essentially, he said pretty straightforwardly that the only Masons that are actually really bad, the ones that you've got to actually watch out for, definitely watch out for, are the political Masons. So if you've got Masons that are involved in politics, they're the political Masons and they're dangerous, right? And so you've got a bunch of these in Trump's cabinet. You had a bunch of these in Obama's cabinet and every single cabinet of the United States dating back to the founding fathers, because George Washington himself was a high-level Freemason. So was nearly every single founding father. And his inauguration ceremony for president was a Masonic inauguration ceremony performed on a black and white Masonic tile floor with white gloves and a white apron, precisely as the rituals contend. So if you think that Freemasonry doesn't have any power or anything like that, just remember, your entire country was founded by it. Every single person that has been your president has been surrounded by it for the entirety of your country's existence. Okay.
People don't
and
believe
you didn't,
this.
And you didn't know it. And you didn't know it until a guy from New Zealand told you. All right?
Right.
That's
right.
How much power and control they've got.
An entertaining introduction to the way that Freemasonry completely permeates Washington, D.C., and indeed the entire street map layout grid of D.C. is one maze and thicket of Freemasonic symbols, is the Dan Brown novel, The Lost Symbol. And I recommend that. It's not the world's greatest page-turning novel, but it's pretty good. And Dan Brown did his homework. And I think he got it pretty much right about the map of D.C. because I've looked at other sources and looked at the historical sources. And yeah, it was Pierre L'Enfant, the architect who laid out D.C., was a Mason. He did it as a Masonic thing. And Dan Brown is portraying D.C. as not only being mapped out by Masons and as having all sorts of architectural and other features from Masonry, but also it's essentially still run by Freemasons through secret handshakes, phone calls to the right people, and so on and so forth. And the plot of this book is that there's a satanic, Aleister Crowley-loving rebel Mason who is rising up against the rest of the order. So he's a lone nut. He's a rogue satanic Mason wreaking havoc and causing mayhem. And the other Masons in Washington, D.C., who basically run D.C. and run America, are trying to keep him under control and catch him and stop him from running amok and slaughtering people. Now, as I read that novel, Vinny, I think that it's a Romana Clay. It's a novel with a key. What it's really about is the fact that there's not just one guy, one satanic Mason who's running amok. There's a whole faction in Masonry that's running amok. And that's what Dan Brown was really writing about.
It's more like Masonry itself has run amok. And,
right, right.
And
well,
within it, there are lone nuts who don't want that to be the case.
So maybe the lone nut is really the good guy. But seriously, Vinny, 9/11 was so obviously a coup d'etat within Freemasonry and by Freemasonry. Look at what got hit. The Twin Towers. What are the biggest symbols of Freemasonry? The two towers of Joachim and Boaz. And then what else got hit? The Pentagon. Well, that's the other big Masonic symbol. There are no bigger symbols in all of Masonry than the Twin Towers and the Pentagram. And that's what got hit on 9/11.
And 11 is two towers, and 9 is 3 times 3. All right, and the highest degree of Freemasonry is 33. So these people basically bury it right in front of your face, and you won't see it. And the reason why a lot of people who are even aware of the symbolism also don't really see it is because the Masons put multiple meanings on each of their symbols that they put up. Okay, that's the whole thing about Freemasonry. It's about duality. That's what the black and white checker on your police force's caps means. Black and white. They control dark and light.
That's interesting. And I've heard that they claim there's some Freemasonic teaching that it's good to be really good and to be really evil. Both. Like you're supposed to be both good and evil. I never understood how that works.
It's called a mind control cult.
Okay.
And how that works is you have a claim of truth that cannot be challenged, and you ensure that anybody who does challenge that truth no longer stays in the cult and gets kicked out and has all the, and if they start talking bad about the cult while they're still in it, they get threatened to have certain privileges that the cult has promised taken away from them in order to keep them in line. If they say things against the cult around other cult members, the other cult members will try to ostracize and herd them back into the fold. So studying cult indoctrination, how they recruit people, how they keep people in the cults, and how they convince people that a cult is not a cult. It's a very, very interesting study that will kind of open up your eyes as to why the world is the way that it is. You know, if you go, I don't understand that, bro. I don't understand. It's because you don't know what cult indoctrination is. It's because you don't know how cult leaders manipulate people. It's because you don't think that there are people out there that are not like you, who don't think like you.
So you're basically saying that through Freemasonry, the world is being run by essentially a group very much like the Moonies.
With less butt cheeks, but yes.
Okay. And now, how about this connection to Zionism? Because one of the big things, you know, as I understand it, this myth of Freemasonry,
let me back
it's almost
up,
like
let me
a
back
religion.
Up, just a sec here. It's not okay. Freemasons running everything. Okay, they're merely one part of the pie of the control structures. You know, you've got a number of different secret societies, a number of different intelligence agencies, a number of military and industrial and banking cartels involved, etc. And there's Masons throughout all of them, and there's CIA agents throughout all of them, and there's British intelligence surveilling all of them, and so on and so forth. It's a ridiculously complicated thing to even try and get your head around it. And I've been trying to get my head around it for the best 8 years, and I'm still no closer today than I was back then. That's how good they've managed to hide all of their schemes. If anybody says to you, hey, there's a really simplistic answer to this that's so easy to understand, you can't believe it, you couldn't think about the it's just like that person's lying to you, or that person's so stupid that they actually believe what they're saying.
Well, it could be, though, that sort of one group within this maze that you're describing has a particular sort of goal and orientation, but then the others would have their own goals and orientations too. Well, and one of the goals of certain folks within that world is this Zionist project of bringing the Jews back to the Holy Land and rebuilding the temple. And that temple is a very big part of Freemasonry. The myth of Freemasonry is about this Hiram the Builder who built the temple for Solomon. And there is, I believe, within some parts of Freemasonry, this sort of, you know, let's rebuild the temple and bring back this glorious past, blah, blah, blah. Just
well,
like the
where
Zionists.
Did Freemasonry come from? Freemasonry came from the Kabbalah, the Jewish numerology religion.
Yes.
Okay. All of the rituals in Freemasonry are based on the Kabbalah. Okay. So, again, anybody who's just pointing the fingers just at the Masons or whatever, they're ignoring its origin and they're ignoring other causal and related factors within its command structure and its ritual abuse of people and how they treat gay people and so on and so forth. It's a very, very complex thing, but it's a terrifying concept.
Because one narrative that attempts to make sense of Freemasonry says that 300-400 years ago, these Kabbalistic Zionist Jews, who were basically part of the same cult founded by people like Shabtai Zvi and then his follow-up leader, Jacob Frank, that these people essentially created Freemasonry as a scam to try, you know, at that time, the Christian church was very powerful and it had a mind lock on everybody. So Freemasonry was an anti-Christian thing. It was designed to get some separation between the minds of the Christian intelligentsia and their religious leaders and to move them over more into the orbit of these Kabbalistic Jews who actually were kind of secular millenarians. That is, they felt if they could sort of destroy Christianity and create a kind of a secular utopia, this was tied in with them, their returning to the Holy Land against the will of God. You know, Shabtai Zvi and his people said that we will commit abominations, we will systematically violate the Ten Commandments and force God's hand. God will then bring our Messiah, put him on the throne in Jerusalem. So they have this anti-religious impulse, especially anti-Christian, and that kind of a satanic impulse as well. And it's tied in with this millenarian secularism. Let's bust up Christianity, bust up religion, and then get the Jews back to Palestine against the will of God as a rebellion against God. And that will, God will be forced to allow us to put our own Messiah on the throne in Jerusalem, and that will bring in the golden age, what have you. And so that's kind of the larger narrative, that Freemasonry is the project of these kind of satanic Jewish heretics. That is, they're not Jews. They're now heretics and Satanists and Shabtai Zvi followers, but they have this project, and that Freemasonry was created by them to realize that project, and that this rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem and putting what we religious people would call the Antichrist on the throne in Jerusalem is really the end game of what they created Freemasonry for.
Mm-hmm. As Jeff Goldblum said, God creates dinosaurs. God destroys dinosaurs. God creates man. Man destroys God. Man creates dinosaurs.
Okay.
You know,
Steven Spielberg made a movie about man creating dinosaurs, but I haven't seen any.
Well, I'm talking about the whole concept of man destroying God, right? Okay. And I think maybe that's a big story too, right there about the fight of the mortal against the immortal, all right? The fight of the limited power against the all-powerful. Now, this concept, to me, it's like giving up, all right? You've got an unwinnable war. What do? You give up, don't you? If you cannot win. But it seems like you seem to have connected a pretty good bunch of strands there that does, in fact, make a whole lot of sense. Because, as I said, if Freemasonry is based on the Kabbalah and Kabbalistic Jews are, in fact, the creators of it, and it has a Zionist agenda or whatever, seems to make a whole bunch of sense. But, of course, that doesn't take into the effect about how many different systems, how many different institutions, and how many different societies that they've already infiltrated in order to force them to pursue those same goals.
Right. And then, of course, everybody has their own personal goals, too.
Mm,
yeah. So on top of these institutional goals, each part of the system, like Lyndon Johnson, who's probably part of this, he always wanted to become president at any price. And so he's happy to help put a bullet in JFK's head in a Freemasonic killing the king ritual. And then, you know, Dulles will participate for another reason. He hates Kennedy because Kennedy fired him. And James Jesus Angleton will participate for another reason because he's the liaison with Mossad and Ben-Gurion is afraid that Kennedy's going to shut down their nuclear program. So all of these people have their own personal motivations. And there is a larger project as well.
That's right. Just like how when Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly shot the president, he then walked very, very slowly down to the basement of the school book depository building and went to the Coke machine and started drinking a Coke.
Sat there drinking a Coke. Yeah.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? You know,
and yeah.
He was just a patsy. Yeah. He was working for the CIA. He visited Russia and learned Russian and so on and so forth. And it seems like the intel community's been infected by this Freemasonic order. The government's been infiltrated. The military definitely has been infiltrated by it. And the police, absolutely. So I watched this interesting YouTube video, and you should definitely watch this too, Kevin. You'll love it. It's called The Keys of Power. And it shows a meta-analysis of how every single government and or religion or whatever, doesn't matter what it is, every single ruling body throughout the world has followed this exact same technique without exception, right? And I was just like, what do you mean, without exception? Without exception. Oh, okay. This is a blueprint for controlling people then, yes? Yes. Okay, well, how do they do it? Well, you know, when you've got a whole bunch of people, they've got a particular skill set or whatever, and together they can accomplish one particular thing. So, for example, you've got this one dude who is so respected among the military that he could order them to betray their own government and they would actually follow his orders because they respect him more than the government. Say, for example, Major General Smedley Butler, who was hired by fascists to overthrow the US government. And he turned whistleblower, and none of those fascists who hired him went to jail, and they're still in charge of the country today. So they tried to get him. That's military. You need the military first and foremost, because if you want to back up any policy, you need the force to be able to do it. The second bunch are law enforcement, slightly different to military. Law enforcement is how you day-to-day threaten people and make them go along with the agenda. Military is what happens when the Shiite Muslim hits the fan, so to speak. All right? And the last one is who's got enough power and money to be able to bribe the people in the military and the people in the police to remain under your control. Okay, how do you satisfy those three people? What are they getting out of it? Who's the head of law and order? Who's the head of the military? And who's the head of the money supply? If you can get those three men, whoever those three men are, who can garner enough support from either of those institutions to all support you, you rule. And the second you stop satisfying them, they will overthrow you and they'll find another dictator that more suits their purposes, somebody who pays them more. Or somebody who gives them more power.
So here in the U.S., do we have a big split developing between different sections of this deep state? It seems like they're, you know, the media is still bashing Trump, and Trump is still bashing the media, and you know, people are up in arms.
Media doesn't matter. You don't need to control the media. You just need to control the military, the police, and the money. Because ultimately, anybody who believes the media is just saying like, oh, you've got to rise up against Trump, and then they try to rise up. If you've got the police and the military on your side, can they rise up? Nope. If you've got enough money to bribe the police and military to follow whatever tyrannical plan you've got, will the people be able to rise up? Nope.
So when they they send the troops in to shut down the media because they think the media is so important.
Exactly. They can do that, and that's why they've got the troops. They don't need the media because the media can be threatened if they decide that they're not on side.
So there you go. So that's why the media covered up the JFK assassination, was they were afraid that they would be basically invaded by thugs in uniform?
Either that, or they were already threatened, or they were already part and working for the OSS or CIA at that time as part of Operation Mockingbird, where the CIA decided that it would put into its control the most major and most respected members of the media at the time to spread misinformation and propaganda in order to confuse their enemies.
And demonize conspiracy theorists. The term conspiracy theorist was put into circulation by a CIA memo to its Operation Mockingbird assets, telling them to insult people looking for the truth about what happened to JFK using the term conspiracy theorist. That's where it came from. And that's where we are today, two professional conspiracy theorists. And we're at the end of our hour.
I hate to be technical. The term conspiracy theorist got popularized and then used to demonize anybody who questioned the official story at that point. However, the term conspiracy theorist has actually been around since the mid-1800s.
Okay, well, it was just the CIA that popularized it then. Well, thank you so much, Vinnie Eastwood. So they can't collect royalties. Good. I'm glad I don't have to pay them. Next week here at True Jihad Radio. And Vinnie Eastwood, you have your own VinnieEastwoodShow.com. People should check that out for sure. I'll link it at my radio blog. So anyway, have a good weekend, everybody. Have a good whatever it is over in New Zealand, Vinnie.